I've spoken here at the library before, but not about my own work, which, if I think hard enough about it, began here. So it's a bit like the return of the native. Happily, things are rather different now than in my day, and are just reminiscing that as students we used to just dump our bags outside on the steps below, and there were mounds of bags. I guess many of you think that Miles Franklin was just really a New South Wales girl, though the fact that you're all here tonight encourages me. She was a New South Wales girl, but there was always a South Australian dimension to her life and work. Moreover, she was here before me. She usually has. I'm not one of those biographers who get to think they are their subjects, but it's always a nice feeling. I'm going to begin with some background and then take a look at a few of those links with South Australia. And here I must thank Paul Wilkins and Cheryl Hoskins for the display of materials out here, all of which are related, or most of them anyway, to what I have to say. I also have three visuals. To my horror, I was hoping they'd just be up there and I wouldn't have to do anything about it, but I have to press something at some point. And indeed, there it is, yes. It's a terrible mistake to get into IT out of your own territory. So please bear with me. The links mostly came in her later years, in the 1930s and the 1940s, but there are one or two earlier ones to be mentioned along the way. I don't need this, do I? One reason I'm happy to be here this evening is that I feel some of those links have not really been noticed before and are of wider significance. Of course, if you'd like, I'll leave some time for questions on these and other matters at the end. Before I begin, let me just say something about the name Stella Miles Franklin. Miles Franklin is by now an Australian icon, pardon the cliche, and she's usually simply known as Miles. However, as some of you may already know, she was liberally endowed with given names. She was baptised Stella Maria Sarah Miles Franklin, that is to say, Miles was her fourth given name. And whereas the first three names all have family significance, Stella, meaning star, came from we don't know where. Maybe it was her father's idea. He was Australian born, and he had a poetic streak, though very little education. As things turned out, it was a nice choice. But more to the point, she was always known to her family and to many friends, including friends in the United States, as Stella. And I must say, the family are very pleased at the title of the book. They're always going around saying, but we called her Stella. Well, there you go. Although my brilliant career appeared under the truncated authorial name Miles Franklin, it was not her choice, and it would take quite a while to settle on Miles. Now, that's the biographical reality. Like everyone else, though, I mostly just call her Miles. One of the interesting things I've learned by now is that people's knowledge about Miles' life is often a bit like a pair of bookends. At one end, there's the rebellious butch girl who wrote My Brilliant Career, which was, by the way, the only significant work of fiction to appear in 1901, the year of Federation. And at the other end sits the Miles Franklin Literary Award, which, to the astonishment of all, she endowed in her will. It was first awarded 3 years later, after her death, to Patrick White in 1957, and is still the most prestigious literary award in this country, and, I would like to emphasise, one of the only international ones. You don't have to be a resident of anywhere in Australia to put an entry in. it doesn't have a residential thing in its rules. So it is actually an international award. As well, of course, there is the Margaret Fink-produced film of 1979, which made her name internationally. When I was at Harvard, I met a woman who said, "I saw the film My Brilliant Career 6 times. These days, My Brilliant Career is on school syllabi, and students wonder why she didn't marry such an attractive man as Harold Beecham, Sam Neill. Of course, a lot happened in between. As many of you here this evening will know, her life was one of enormous range, especially for an Australian girl of the period, with a long time spent working in Chicago in the fledgling women's trade union movement there. The photo of her as a young woman dates from those years. She is actually nearly 30 there, a bit over 30 there, so she was wearing quite well, wasn't she? Or maybe they just had very good photographers in Chicago. And then another in London during and after the Great War, where she worked for a housing reform association in Bloomsbury, though not with much enthusiasm. Housing, she said, is something anyone can believe in. She also served as a hospital orderly in Macedonia during the Great War, one of the happiest times of her life, despite catching malaria there. She was, as the blurb to the book cover has it, I didn't write it, a novelist, journalist, nationalist, feminist, and larrikin. All that and more. And like all human beings, I should add, at times during her eventful life, rather less. One of my reviewers couldn't see why there was information about her teeth in the biography. Well, they were poor, as many people's teeth were then. And she was often in pain because of them, not to mention the cost of having them fixed. I should think there are people here who can relate to that problem. So you can see why it had to be a big book. There it is, sitting over there. I hope in the end it shows that although always troubled and apparently paradoxical, it was in the end an almost coherent life. The thing that never wavered was her commitment to Australia and to its literature, even during the hectic years away. It was exciting to discover the number of articles she sent home for publication in local newspapers during those years, which was quite a large research exercise in a library, something like this, the State Library, actually. A selection of them, if you're interested, can be consulted in the edition we did called A Gregarious Culture, which was published by the University of Queensland Press in 2001, and so far as I know, is still in print. And now it's clear that when she finally returned home for good in 1932, and she did return, unlike many expatriates of the period, it was because she thought the time was ripe for a great leap forward on the literary front, both for her own work and for other Australian writers. Which brings me at last to my topic, Miles' links with South Australia. As I've already indicated, mostly the story is about the years after she came home in late 1932. By then, Miles Franklin was aged 53, and things didn't turn out as she hoped in the small and frequently irritating literary world of Sydney, riddled, as all literary cultures were at that time, with severe censorship. Even worse, she returned to find that her aged mother in the southern Sydney suburb of Carlton was becoming increasingly demented. As my colleague Marilla North said to me only the other day, considering how hard it is to cope with such a situation today, how she managed that in the 1930s is impressive. And she did manage it. Furthermore, although things didn't turn out in literary terms as she hoped, they were definitely on the move in the 1930s for her as well as for other Australian writers. The 50s can sometimes be the best years for women. And this is where South Australian dimension begins to matter in her life. Not immediately, but soonish. In July 1936, she was awarded the Bulletin's Prior Prize for the outstanding novel of the year, the rambunctious pastoral saga, All That Swagger. Her most popular book for years thereafter, but alas, now out of print. It is over there on display out of the library's rare books. It was soon after that, in early 1937, that she accepted an invitation to accompany the travel writer Frank Clune and his wife, Thelma, on a trip to Central Australia via the Riverina and Adelaide. Frank wanted her to help him write his books. He didn't write very many of them himself. And Miles was delighted to go, though it took some organising to get the help necessary for her mother for the month or so they were away in June, July 1937. You can see here Miles looking mighty pleased about the trip in the picture of her by a furphy cart over there. It was probably taken one Saturday in June when Clune's Pontiac got bogged on the saltbush plains near Moolamain, and comes originally from a wonderful collection of trip photos taken by Clune, which is preserved in the Franklin Papers. Her diary for that bogged event, a page of it I have photocopied, and it too appears in the display case. Now, I particularly like this quaint pic, as I feel sure Miles loved having it taken. The furphy cart, I wonder, does anyone know what a furphy cart is? Who hasn't already cheated and read it in my book? You do? You do? What is it?
It was a water cart, really.
That's right. The furphy cart was a water cart, widely used by soldiers in World War I. So called because it was made by Furphy and Co. at Shepparton, and it had a special resonance for Miles because one of the Furphy family, Joseph Furphy, was her absolute favourite in Australian writing. She never ceased to sing the praises of his one big book, Such is Life, published by the Bulletin in 1903. She believed that it set Austlitt on the right course, and once boldly compared it in print, in terms of technique, with James Joyce's Ulysses. As often as possible, I like to let Miles speak for herself. And as it happens, the trip to Central Australia, to Mount Stewart, it was Alice Springs, Mount Stewart, is well documented in her pocket diary, in her literary notebook. There's a substantial excerpt from the literary notebook account in Paul Brunton's edition of her diaries and notebooks, which came out in 2004, if you would like to read a bit more of it, and in a personal letter, as well as in that photographic series. Here's what she wrote about her trip in a letter to an American friend soon after she got back. Quote, "I had a wonderful change. I was hardly strong enough, or rather was too fatigued when I went away for the hard travelling, but the relief from the care of my mother and being confined in such an enervating circle was wonderful. I went with two friends, Mr. and Mrs. Clune, by car to Adelaide, and we wandered all around the Murrumbidgee towns, which is called my country, as Wessex in England is called Hardy's country. And then followed the Murray to the sea. From Adelaide, we flew to the centre of Australia and then to the geographic centre of Australia. Look at a map. In all, 3,000 miles by car and 2,000 by plane. It was a lovely Lockheed Electra, and we saw the red heart of Australia and the bed of Lake Eyre and the McDonnell Ranges, colours ravishing, like your Grand Canyon Colorado stretches, only, of course, flat." end quote. Wherever they went, Miles and Frank usually advised the local press of their coming. In Adelaide, Clune told the Advertiser he was collecting material for two books, viz. A historic travel book dealing with the Murrumbidgee and a historical romance in collaboration with Miss Miles Franklin. And how this must have amused Miles, then aged 57, going 58, said to be a young New South Wales authoress. During the stopover in Adelaide, Miles visited Hans Heisen at Harndorf, where she had lunch with the great man. How wonderful that was, the great artist and she, the happy wandering writer. What's more, she loved his paintings. And from then on, Miles Franklin extolled the gum tree as the quintessential Australian symbol and was greatly mocked for that, though basically she was just ahead of her time, as South Australian-born writer Murray Bale would demonstrate in his prize-winning novel Eucalyptus. Perhaps I might add a personal note that in getting myself in the mood to prepare this presentation, I went for a walk to look at the bloodwoods up my street. They are in majestic bloom this year. Another spin-off from the stopover reached back in time to Miles' first difficult years in Chicago, when her mentor there, Melbourne journalist Alice Henry, wrote to far-off Catherine Helen Spence about Miles' health. The letters, the exchange is in Ever Yours, a valuable collection of Spence writing, edited by Susan McGarry and Associates. There's no record to indicate if Miles knew about their concern, but as is recorded in her pocket diaries, which begin a little later, when travelling by ship back and forth to London in later times, she always called on Spence's niece in North Adelaide. And in 1937, get this, Ray, she arranged for precious Spence materials to be forwarded to the Mitchell Library in Sydney. A great coup, I'm sure, could not happen today. Yes. Nor was that all. Back in Sydney, Miles gave two talks, one of them entitled Australia's Greatest Woman. People wanted to know who that might be and were told to wait and see. That is my surprise, she said, and it probably was a surprise. Australia's greatest woman, according to Miles, was none other than Catherine Helen Spence. Famous in her day, but the 1930s, Spence was not well known, I think even in South Australia, though I will defer to the authorities present, and certainly not in New South Wales. And her novels, written by the 1850s, in the 1850s and 1860s, were long out of print, as I believe they still are, or currently are. Anyway, she now had a great new advocate in Miles. According to Miles, and she was right, the characters in Spence's early novel Clara Morrison, A Tale of South Australia During the Gold Fever, this was what our forebears were really like. Now, I guess I'd better push on to later links if there's to be time for questions. When Miles finally returned to Australia, she was full of the idea that Australia was the coming field for fiction, just as other countries she knew, especially America, had been earlier and by now boasted significant literatures of their own. Having won that big prize herself in 1936, she felt hope that a new day was dawning. The pall of empire was lifting and new voices, autochthonous voices she called them, a big word, she loved words, a big word meaning native born, could rise and be heard. Now, as it happened, one of the movements which she found most hopeful was an emergent school of writers from South Australia. I refer to the Jindy Warrabak movement, which I shall, like everyone else, call the Jindies. The Jindies espoused environmental values and attempted to incorporate Indigenous languages into their writings. Some of it, I believe, is quite impressive for its time, although its main importance lies in the fact that it was the first to attempt such things. As founder Rex Ingermills, a teacher and poet who was born at Oraru, put it, quote, "The stage has been reached when, after a vigorous era of colonisation, Australians should take stock of the past and present and so give effective thought to the future." End of quote. For miles, they were on the right track. Moreover, she thought, they were winning the battle. Celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Jindiwarabak movement in 1948, and we have in the display over there, I think, a series of the Jindiwarabak publications, which she read, she said firmly, "Australia will be expressed." She went on, and here I'm quoting from something longer, which is reprinted in that collection of topical writings I mentioned earlier. "Jindiism, so long as it doesn't serve the menacing politics of isolationism or sovereign state nationalism, is the focus for a fresh contribution to world literature, working from a new core outward to international recognition." What was this new core? It was a lot clearer then now, of course, in the 1940s, when fear of invasion had been intense. But some took it too far at that time. One who nearly did was the South Australian poet Ian Mudie. Now, Ian Mudie was just about perfect as far as Miles was concerned. She put him alongside Furphy and Spence. Just about perfect. A rangy, versatile, did all sorts of things, figure. I do write about it, so I won't. You probably know anyway. She helped him out of the excesses of the Australia First movement in Sydney and praised him when he kept a straight course thereafter. It was she who encouraged him to follow an American model for his long poem, The Australian Dream, which was first published by the Jindiwarabak Club. And here I am fortunate enough to possess a first edition of that long poem, The Australian Dream, and I think perhaps there's another one over there. And lo and behold, when you get it, you see down under the illustration the initials MP, Margaret Preston, who did other covers, I discovered today, for the Jindis. Going back to her remarks after 10 years. Does what she said sound about as long as it doesn't serve the menacing politics of isolation or sovereign state nationalism? Does that sound familiar? On the other, it may not, because it's a reminder of the 1940s and the impact of war and the challenge that war presented to everyone, writers included. Well now, what was Mudie on about? Over there we also have a collection, I think. Did we get Poets at War? No, we didn't, and I don't have it. I wonder how many school children learn bits of the Australian Dream or poems out of Poets at War in the 1950s, or as I did, They'll Tell You About Me. See, they were very advanced on Eyre Peninsula. And indeed, if anyone outside South Australia these days has heard of Mudie, well, I would be a bit surprised. Actually, I'm not too sure how many people here may have. But I'm just a blow-in, and I mustn't offend. I know that I've been going on a bit about people who may not be of much interest now, but I think they should be, and I'm not likely to get another chance to say so. The things they stood for have been out of fashion for a couple of generations, and they certainly won't appeal to everyone. But there's a lot to chew on. And there's a sizeable correspondence between Miles and Mudie sitting up there in the State Library, and it's surely time someone took another look at it. Is there someone looking for a thesis topic out there? Another instance of that state South Australian dimension to Miles Franklin's worldview in later years, and this must be the last for now, is a brief association with Myrtle Rose White, author of No Roads Go By, among other children's books. Actually, when I came to ask myself what they were, I don't think I can remember, but there was more than one anyway. I wouldn't make too much of this link, as it was mainly a rather ineffectual support for Miles during Miles' last sad struggle with her airman nephew, John, a victim of war neurosis. Myrtle was a spiritualist, which Miles certainly was not, though many of her early friends were Christian Scientists, and she did indeed dabble in it. I don't think the Christian Science Church is up there on North Terrace now. Is it? Wow. In any event, Myrtle was often in Sydney in the early 1950s and did her best to help, though she does seem to be a bit overawed by Miles. Even when Miles did her best and gave her the honour of giving her tea from the Waratah cup and saucer, which was one of her great treasures and is now in the State Library and is indeed one of the symbols of Miles Franklin, the Waratah cup and saucers. It's a beautiful little thing. I always think it's a pity that by then Miles wasn't strong enough to accept Myrtle's invitation to visit her son's station at Lalla Rookh near Port Hedland in Western Australia. She never got further north than Perth. And she never went to Tasmania. She said it was too cold down there. I hope you can tell from these vignettes of Ingemels, Mudie and Myrtle Rose that there's more to be said about the relevance of a South Australian dimension to the shaping of an Australian literature in the 1940s. I'm running out of time, and anyway, a biographer like me must stay focused on her subject. So, to conclude, let me make two points in that regard. The first is that Ingemels and Mudie were a great help to Miles as she struggled to get her work out towards the end of her life. She never wasted anything. She never threw it out. And she got a remarkable lot of it published. Big struggle. What became perhaps the most important one that Ingemels and Mudie did was help her get out My Career Goes Bung, which she drafted way back in 1902 after My Brilliant Career, and finally saw the light of day in 1946, thanks to Mudie and Ingemels, Ingemels being by then a Melbourne publisher's rep. The second point is the obverse, that Miles was able to support them in Sydney and to treat them to her famous hospitality at her cottage in Carlton when in town. In the final chapter of my book, there's a story of an unannounced visit to her at Carlton by some of the Jindiwarabak poets in 1951, by which time Miles looked like that press photo. Aha, on display. Ah, yes, I think I'll have some help here. Let's get it right. Thank you. By which time, actually this is her in Melbourne in 1952, and the heading says Miles Franklin visits us. But so it's just a year or so later from the incident I'm going to recount. I'd like to end with the story of that visit, as recalled in the memoirs of young Sydney poet Nancy Keesing, whom they had in tow. In her memoir, Keesing confessed to being scared stiff, as Miles always sounded so redoubtable, despite her usually gentle appearance and demeanour. But Nancy was soon put at her ease. It was a wet evening, and the men had to stand on the veranda while Miles helped Nancy dry her hair. "You must never be a doormat," Miles told her. Later, in the small, warm living room with decorative soil samples glowing in jars on the mantelpiece, some probably from that trip to Central Australia in 1937, she served supper. They didn't drink much in those days. In fact, there was no alcohol in this. Nancy took tea from the Waratah cup, which, like so many others, she feared to drop. And she signed Miles' autograph book, which was had a Waratah on the front of that, the Waratah book. She didn't care for the writings of her hostess, but she found Miles Franklin an irresistible woman. Quote, "I almost loved her. Her conversation was fun." Of course, there was more to it, and the struggle they were all engaged in still matters. Thank you for having me, and may what I have called the South Australian dimension, which Miles Franklin was so quick to perceive, soon stand out more clearly. After all, it is something to be proud of. Thank you.